200-inch telescope has made some stunning new photographs showing Battlestar Galactica approaching Earth. If they were indeed photographing Battlestar Galactica, they would probably be using the technique designed by Harold Edgerton, which is happens to be our next lecturer coming up this month, October 19 and 20. Mr. Edgerton perfected the modern stroboscope, which made stop action and high-speed photography possible. His results have been quite spectacular, taking a BB, for example, dropping it into a drop of water and getting a beautiful little coronet sort of design as the droplets are coming off out of the water. The September issue of Omni magazine describes him as a photographer's cult hero, a grizzled explorer, distinguished professor, inventor of everything from Brownie flash tubes to laser strobes. Since his stuff was first introduced to the public in 1931, the electronic flash system has become global and lunar and enriched the vision that we have in the way we see the world. The equipment has also been used in search of the monitor underwater, used for the exploration of the Loch Ness Monster. Jacques Cousteau and his staff also use the same material, and Edgerton made 10 voyages aboard the Calypso. And Mr. Cousteau dubbed him Papa Flash. He also put together several films. Quicker Than a Wink is a short film. It was made with his equipment, won an Oscar. In 1973, he received the National Medal of Science from the National Science Foundation. We are scheduling two lectures on a Friday night and a Saturday night, October 19 and 20. There are, we do expect a large demand for this, so we have two lectures instead of just the one. The ticket price for non-members is $350 for adults, $250 for students. For members, it's $250 for adults, $150 for students. So it's paid to belong. I've been told that tonight's lecture will be a real gas by Peter. And without further ado, I'd like to bring Jim Rohn back up to the podium. Wait till next week.
Actually, it's very easy to tell the two of us apart. Our appearance is nothing like the same. I'm that wild-eyed maniac you saw a picture of in the free press wearing pink pants. See, that's the difference. And he wears a tie besides. I want to make a few announcements myself before we got started. One of them is that tomorrow at Oakland University, which is not terribly far from here, half an hour drive or so, I am going to give a lecture which is not particularly new. So I've given lectures there, you know, many times. I've given lectures all over the place many times. But this particular one happens not to duplicate anything else that I'm doing in Michigan or, for that matter, anywhere else in the country for the rest of the year. It is material that is totally not included in the current series. So I wanted especially to draw it to your attention since it is, you know, one, completely different material, and two, nearby. The lecture will be about what we discovered on the moon. And this is, in fact, a lecture that I got started with. The first one that I ever gave for many years. It was the only one anybody ever asked me for, because I would give it at one place, and people would call me up and say, hey, I hear you have this fantastic moon lecture. And I'd say, but I've got other lectures too. No, we want this fantastic moon lecture. It's called being typecast. In any case, this is the current version of it. The title is 10 Years After the Eagle Landed, What We Discovered on the Moon. As most of you are probably aware, July 20th was the 10th anniversary of the first man landing on the moon. And it is absolutely free and worth every penny of it. It begins at, I forget what it begins. Either 7 or 7:30, I think it's 7:30. 7:30 p.m. I don't know at this point where in Oakland it's going to be. Probably room 201 Dodge Hall of Engineering. But it should be possible to phone and find out where it is. The mimeograph sheets in the back, most of you probably have copies by this time, but those schedules of all of my lectures plus all of the other things that are sponsored by University of Michigan and that are not done by me, schedules are in the back. Buried at the bottom of page 2 under elsewhere, it says Rochester, Michigan, and gives the phone number for you to call and get more information. To get to Oakland University is very simple. You drive north on I-75, I don't know, depending where you start, 15 minutes, half an hour, whatever, and it's a lot of city. I don't know where to tell county. I mean, you know, Detroit and suburbs are so big, there's no obvious zero reference point, and they don't have exit numbers on that stretch of the freeway for some reason. So, you know, all I can tell you is drive north until you see signs saying you're coming to Rochester, and you want to take the University Drive exit, so it's very easy to remember, right? University Drive goes to the university. And you simply follow the signs, you know, get off the freeway at University Drive, go straight east of University Drive until you pass through the gates. You know, it's the easiest thing in the world. Much easier to get through the deer, frankly. You know, much easier to get directions for. Just inside the gate, there is a campus map, and you can pull over, you know, a little place where you can pull your car over and look at the map. And probably there will be a sign there saying where it is. Unless, well, last time I gave a lecture there, I got pushed off the sign by a Regents meeting. But assuming there is another one, should be in there. Second announcement is this. Apparently, we have given some of you a false impression that this is for experts only, that the series is for experts only, and I think we've given some of the kids the impression that they're supposed to sit there and shut up and this series is for grown-ups. Please let me try as hard as I can to correct those impressions. A lot of the people, you know, at a lecture like this, naturally, we're going to have a fair amount of background, and equally naturally, a lot of people are going to have none whatsoever. And it's really for that second group that the lectures are intended. Because the people that have some background can understand, say, articles in Science Telescope, can get a fair amount of this material elsewhere. What we're really doing this series for is those people who have no previous background in astronomy and planetology, perhaps in science at all, but are interested in what we are discovering in the universe around us with your tax money, after all, and cannot get it anywhere else because nobody else is explaining at the elementary level. So just because we get some fairly esoteric questions does not mean that if somebody, you know, doesn't understand some, if I'm taking for granted that you understand some basic scientific principle and is not realizing, oh, wait a minute, of course I should have explained that. For heaven's sake, raise your hand and ask. And so, that especially goes for the kids. Do not assume, kids, that you are supposed to sit there and not understand anything and get bored. Now, that's the last thing I want you to do. So, you know, please, there is no such thing as a dumb question. There are people who are too dumb to ask questions, and that's all there is. You know, don't be afraid of being laughed at. And sometimes, in fact, people start off by saying, gee, this is a really stupid question. I always wish, because very often, those are the most profound ones. You know, there's a whole class of questions that are asked only by five-year-old children and great philosophers. And when they start out by saying, this is a really stupid question, and then I don't know the answer, I look so off. So please, don't do that. Okay. And what I want to do, then apparently some people were saying to the Cranbrook people, you know, last week, gee, this is too much science knowledge, and I didn't want to do that, you know. And I thought about it, and the reason is that I was just unconsciously assuming on the basis of the questions we did get, and how much knowledge you had. So I want to start out, maybe this is a little belated, you know, because I'd like to ask questions as we go along, rather than, you know, try to piece it together from understanding later. But I'd like to start out by asking if you have any questions, very complex, very simple, or anything at all in between, that we haven't had a chance to get to so far. In other words, anything about the two Venus lectures, or for that matter, you know, anything else that seems to fit in. Yeah, please.
You said the extra layer of Venus is going around
in 48. Right.
What was it going around?
That is one of the big unsolved questions about Venus. Can anybody hear the question, or should I repeat it? What's making the, what's causing the wind in the upper cloud layer of Venus, and also the clear atmosphere above it, and extending down variable depths, depending on which landing you talk about, it tends to go up and down as to where the bottom of this regime is. These very, very high winds, 200, 300 miles an hour, which cause cloud features to go around the planet every 4 days, whereas the planet itself is going around every 243. Nobody knows the answer to that one. It's one of the big unsolved mysteries of Venus. We are hoping that as a result of analysis of all of the pressure and temperature and wind data from the various Pioneer Venus probes, that we will eventually be able to answer that one. At the moment, though, it's just one of the big, you know, one of the reasons we sent Pioneer Venus there in the first place. So, the reason you understand that one is nobody does. Okay, somebody else? Everybody else understood every single thing other than that? Okay, well, look, if you have any, you know, please ask them as you go along, and apparently some people thought I was taking questions only from the front. It's entirely possible, you know, they're the ones I see, but you don't have to raise your hand, it's dark anyway, just yell question or jam or, you know, anything you think will get my attention that is not obscene or libelous, and I will be more than happy to call on. Okay, let us have the lights out and the first slide on, and I will start talking to you about Jupiter. Yeah, please. Go ahead. Repeat the remarks about the appearance of life on this planet that I made in the first lecture. Frankly, I forget what I said. Well, we think, okay, basically the difference, let's turn the lights back up. Basically the difference between living things and non-living things from a chemist's point of view is that living things are made of much more complex molecules. Molecules with many more atoms in them, and molecules with perhaps many different kinds of atoms, but the basic thing is lots of different atoms, millions, tens of millions of atoms in some cases. Whereas non-living things are in general made of much simpler molecules. Water, for example, is a molecule that consists of one atom of oxygen and two atoms of hydrogen. Well, that's only three. You know, compare that to a protein, you get the picture. Somehow, if life originated on the primitive Earth by chemical processes, given the fact that most of the universe consists of these very simple molecules, somehow the simple molecules must have gotten together, there must have been a series of chemical reactions which eventually led to complex ones. There may have been many other series of chemical reactions going on at the same time that weren't getting anywhere as far as life is concerned. I don't want to imply that there is anything, I'm not trying to go theological on you, I'm not trying to imply there was any necessary direction to this, but obviously it happened. You know, one at least of those strands of sets of reactions happened to produce life, because here we are. And it seems to have happened quite early in the history of the planet. We know from several lines of evidence, some of which I gave you, that the Earth was molten during or immediately after its formation. You couldn't have had living things then. You could have had complex molecules then. The heat is too great. It tears them apart. And yet, the oldest rocks that are known on the Earth, which are from Greenland and are 3.8 billion years old, have in them organic substances which, although this is more controversial than I appreciated a couple of weeks ago, I since found out, at least there is a very good indication that those are organic residues from living things. So, you know, it happened in a period of time that may be long by human time scales, maybe it took millions, tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years, but that is still, even hundreds of millions, is short by geologic time scales. And it seems to have happened just as soon as it possibly could. How it happened, however, we don't know. There is a classic experiment that was done in the 1950s by Miller and Urey, in which they took some gases which in those days they thought the primitive atmosphere of the Earth might have been made of. Nowadays we think differently, but it doesn't matter, because similar experiments have been done with many different kinds of atmospheres, and it's amazing the variety of atmospheres you can use and the variety of energy sources you can use that all produce the same result. They took a mixture of water vapor, methane, and ammonia, which are chemicals that are very common in the universe. You get them in Jupiter, you get them in comets, you get them in nebulae, the clouds of gas and dust between the stars, and so forth. And they are common for a very simple reason. They are the compounds of hydrogen, which is the most abundant single kind of atom in the universe, with respectively oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen, which are respectively the third, fourth, and fifth most abundant elements in the universe. And the second most abundant doesn't count, because that's helium, it doesn't form compounds, it doesn't engage itself in chemistry. So they took those substances and had a flask composed of them, put a spark through it for a week to simulate lightning on the primeval Earth, and at the end of that week they had a horrible brown gunk in the bottom of the flask, which had substances all the way up to amino acids, which are very complex organic substances and which are the building blocks of protein. Turns out you can do the same thing with a lot of other different kinds of atmospheres and get similar results. And a little bit later on, I want to tell you about the significance to all this of the fact that Voyager 1 discovered lightning in the atmosphere of Jupiter. But, get that. Okay, is that, I'm not sure exactly what you wanted, because I don't remember exactly what I said. I threw it in kind of, you know, it came up, and I threw it in kind of ad lib, but that was probably the more or less the high point. Okay, we had another question or two or six. Yeah. No. Believe me, I told you everything I know about that last time. I mean, the reason that I spent so much time going through the layers, you know, the properties of them in detail, was just to give you some idea of the staggering complexity that there is. Nobody's expecting anything like that. And therefore, the great difficulty we're going to have in trying to explain that complexity. you know. But if you feel mystified and amazed and frustrated as a result of the complexity of that structure, that's exactly where you should be at this point. I have brought you up to the level of confusion and ignorance enjoyed by the expert. Hand over there. Contained organic substances.
Contained organic substances. And then you said earlier that on Earth, if that humans are organic, something to do with life.
Not necessarily. That's the problem. The word organic. Originally, in the history of chemistry, chemists thought that there were two completely separate, unrelated classes of substances. Organic, and that's what life was made of, and inorganic, and that was everything else, and you could not make organic out of inorganic. That has long since been exploded. A guy named Friedrich Wöhler in 1850-something, I believe, synthesized urea, which is an organic substance, out of inorganic things, and, you know, it just took the scientific world by storm. But the problem is we still use the same old wrong terminology. The basic way I describe the two words now is the word organic means carbon compounds, and it is given that name because carbon compounds include the substances living things are made of, but are not restricted to them. A good example of something that no living thing has ever made, and yet is organic, and is quite a complex substance, is DDT. Made only in the laboratory, but it's an organic substance. Well, I cut you off in the middle, but was that what you were asking?
Right.
Okay.
I didn't
understand
the
800 million was the time. No, 800 million was the time when you had the first fairly complex life. Anything more complex than single-celled organisms. Okay. And the reason for that, well, okay, I can't go into this in very great detail because I'm supposed to be talking about Jupiter and it's really another whole lecture. But it turns out that through most of the history of the Earth, and this is a recent discovery, about 3 years old, through most of the history of the Earth, up until about 800 million years ago, the temperature was near the boiling point of water. And then it rather suddenly fell about 800 million years ago, probably as a result of the development of photosynthetic organisms, that is, organisms that that produce oxygen as a byproduct, as a waste product. And the oxygen attacked, we think, substances in the atmosphere, namely leftover little trace amounts, parts per million, of methane and ammonia. Those have a very, very good greenhouse effect. Remember greenhouse effect, the effect of a gas holding in heat in an atmosphere. Those have a very good greenhouse effect, and as soon as you got rid of them, the temperature would have fallen. Now, it's not as simple as I'm making out, because during that period, most of which the temperature was near the boiling point of water, we have abundant geologic evidence for an ice age every once in a while. So there's a lot about the Earth's climatic history that we don't understand even recently. You know, we don't know what causes the current ice age, we're now in an interglacial, but, you know, it'll come back. The one that's been going on for 2 or 3 million years with these occasional recessions, we don't understand what's causing that. You know, we understand it partial, but we don't know what turned it on 2 or 3 million years ago. Sure. Other questions? Now, those are from the front. Now, people are complaining I wasn't taking questions in the back. Unless there's some really major breakthrough that causes me to change the priorities, and, you know, I don't expect that'll happen. Today's Jupiter, next time is moons of Jupiter, and the final lecture time after that is Saturn and a little bit about its moons. Okay? Okay, let's have the white Saturn tell you about Jupiter. Jupiter, this picture of Jupiter from the Earth, one of the very finest we ever took. And it may look as though it's pretty good until you realize that's only because Jupiter is so huge. In fact, it's a lousy picture, pretty fuzzy. Smallest things you can see on it are about 1,000 miles across, and even then only in perfect contrast. And indeed, the sharpest things you see on this picture are the dust grains, which I find have gotten to be fairly populous on this slide. I've given Jupiter lectures quite a bit over the last few months. To give you an idea of the scale of what you're seeing, there is Io, or Io, whichever pronunciation you like, I won't argue. It is about the size of our own moon. There, you can see how red it is, by the way, and next week you'll find out that's important. It's redder than Mars. In fact, it was the reddest object known in the solar system until Voyager 1 discovered an even redder one in orbit around Jupiter, Amalthea. Here is the shadow of Io on the surface of Jupiter, which is cloud, and that little tiny shadow is about the distance across the United States. So Jupiter is an enormous object. It is not just the biggest planet. Jupiter is 2.5 times as heavy as all the other planets, moons, asteroids, comets, meteoroids, you name it, in the solar system put together. You are seeing 2/3 of the solar system right there. That's it, Jupiter. Jupiter is so big that if it were hollow, you could drop in over 1,000 Earths and still have room left over. The great red spot there is 2.5 times the diameter of the Earth. So if the Earth were in this picture, it would be a circle that looked about like that. But Jupiter is not only very much larger than the Earth, it is also a totally different kind of object. So different that it's really misleading to use the same word planet to refer to both of them. Jupiter, for example, has no solid surface whatsoever. What you're seeing there, what looks like a surface when you look at it through telescopes, is entirely clouds. They are cold. Jupiter is 500 million miles from the Sun. Those clouds are made of frozen ammonia, and possibly some of the ones you're seeing are frozen ammonium hydrosulfide, which is the chemical compound of ammonia gas plus hydrogen sulfide gas, both of which should have been present in the material that made up Jupiter. In either case, in some cases there, the clouds are white, which is the natural color of either a frozen ammonia cloud or frozen ammonium hydrosulfide. In some cases they are colored by various impurities, which may be organics of non-living origin, may even be organics of living origin, although life in Jupiter doesn't seem terribly likely at the moment. May be simpler things, for example, it's been suggested the reason the Great Red Spot is red, or as Carl Sagan likes to say, the Great Red Spot is so named because it is orange. Whatever, the coloration may be due to phosphorus, which comes up from inside Jupiter, carried up by upwelling atmosphere. We know this is a region of upwelling atmosphere. We know that from the Pioneer 10 and 11 studies that preceded the Voyagers by a few years. And precipitates out, condenses out when it gets to the temperature of the Great Red Spot. The Great Red Spot clouds are the coldest that you're seeing on the whole planet. They're about 15 degrees colder than anybody else. But a good average temperature for these clouds is about 150 below zero Fahrenheit. So you see, it is very cold, and the clouds are not made of water like our clouds. We are quite certain, given the amount of water that must be present in Jupiter's atmosphere, that there are clouds made of first frozen water, and then below those, clouds made of liquid water droplets further down in the atmosphere. But you've got all these ammonia things higher up, and they would hide them. So we don't think we've ever seen water, actually seen water clouds in a picture like this. Further inside, however, Jupiter is very, very hot. A few thousand miles below the cloud top, which is so small I can't even show it to you on this side, on a picture of this scale, already the temperature is hot enough to melt any metal. And if you could get to the center of Jupiter, according to the Pioneer 10 and 11 gravity data, if you could tunnel in through the 43,000 miles of material that planet is made of and get to the very center, the temperature there would be 54,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 6 times as hot as the surface of the Sun. So Jupiter has no solid material whatever. It is made mostly of hydrogen and helium. Those are by far the two most abundant materials in the universe. If the gravity of the object, back when the solar system formed 4.6 billion years ago, was great enough to hold those two light gases, in the case of Earth, of course, it was not. If the gravity was great enough to hold them, then the planet would be made mostly of hydrogen and helium. And so Jupiter is. The Earth is not because the gravity wasn't enough to hold them. But, yeah?
I think somewhere it's
better to describe Jupiter as a small star. No, it's not. I know you've heard that. I want to get to that in a moment. It is a very bad way to describe. It's a very bad way of expressing a very important point, namely that Jupiter is very different from the Earth. But Jupiter is at least as different from a star as it is different from a terrestrial planet, a dense, small, rock-type planet such as the Earth. And really what you've got is three completely different kinds of bodies in the solar system. You have a star, the Sun, you have four Jovian planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and you have about 12 terrestrial planets, some of which are, you may be shocked when I say 12, some of those are the large moons of the outer planets, which are full-sized planets themselves. It's just they aren't planets by the strict definition of the term. They don't revolve directly around the Sun, they revolve around a Jovian planet, which itself revolves around the Sun. I'll have more to say about these planet-sized moons next time. Question back there? Okay, a Jovian planet is a planet like Jupiter that is made mostly of hydrogen and helium, and after that, hydrogen compounds with the next most abundant materials, and so that means water, methane, and ammonia in that order down, and only then do you get to rock. There is probably rocky material in Jupiter. There should be, by theoretical calculations, enough rocky material in Jupiter to be about 3 times as heavy as the Earth, but it all would have fallen down to the center of the planet. And it's so hot there that even there, it would not form a solid surface. At 54,000 degrees, it would be molten, if not gaseous. In fact, when you get into the kind of pressure that you get inside a planet like this, the pressure is so enormous that you squeeze the hydrogen and helium, which it's mostly made of, into a substance that you might as well call a liquid because it's so dense. So as you go down inside the planet, it gets denser and denser and denser and denser, and finally you get to some level where you might as well call it a liquid, but there is no clear-cut transition where the liquid starts. It just becomes denser and denser, and it's a matter of semantics where he defines where the liquid starts, because it's all the same material. On Earth, if you go from the atmosphere into the ocean, there is no question where the gas stops and the liquid starts, but that's because you're going from one set of substances to a completely different substance. It's not just the same stuff, only more squeezed. Here's the same stuff, only more squeezed. But a reasonable guess for where the gas stops and the liquid starts would be about 1,000 miles down, which means essentially the entire planet is liquid. Something that is squeezed so much that you would call it a liquid. And in fact, through most of the interior, it is squeezed so badly that the electrons have actually been squeezed off the outsides of the atoms and are wending their way in between the bare nuclei as best they can. And therefore, a given electron belongs to the whole material, not to a given atom. That is a metal. And so most of the interior of Jupiter, starting about that far down, so all this volume here, until you go all the way into the little rocky core in the center, molten rocky and metal core in the center, all the rest of it is liquid metallic hydrogen mixed with helium and other things like water and methane and ammonia. So it's a very different kind of body from the Earth. Saturn, we found out from Pioneer 11, has the same sort of structure, except the numbers are different. The liquid metallic hydrogen region is much smaller. Saturn is mostly hydrogen that is squeezed enough to be a liquid, but not enough to be a metal. And it has a rocky core about the same size as Jupiter's. And Uranus and Neptune, we don't know much about. They're probably mostly hydrogen and helium. Some people think they may have lost a fair amount of their hydrogen and helium to the point where the water, methane, and ammonia are, by default, more important. But a Jovian planet is one of these liquid, low-density, lightweight jobs, as opposed to the other kind of planet, a terrestrial planet named for the Earth, which is a planet that, although it is not anything like as big as a Jovian planet, is a good deal denser, because it is made only of those substances that were solid at the place in the cloud of gas and dust the solar system formed out of, where the particular body formed, and in the case of the Earth, what that means is made of rock. I'll give you an immediate intuitive picture that will instantly tell you the difference between a Jovian planet and a terrestrial planet. Jupiter is pretty concentrated because of its own weight, but Saturn is big enough that it's mostly hydrogen and yet not big enough to be too terribly compressed on the inside. Saturn is so low in density that if you could find a bathtub big enough, Saturn would float in it like a cork. Saturn is less dense than an equal volume of water would be. Now, if you imagine taking the Earth and putting it in some giant bathtub and expecting it to float, you know, expecting it to bob up to the surface, of course it wouldn't. It would sink like the stone that it is. In fact, a stone with an iron core that it is. And immediately that gives you the picture. The other difference, of course, is that when you let the water out of the bathtub, Saturn would leave a ring. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, Saturn does too, we found out from Pioneer 11. And in fact, that's the next thing I was going to get to, that although Jupiter is very cold on the outside where those clouds are, as soon as you get a few thousand miles inside, it becomes very, very hot. And it does, in fact, that fact was discovered even before we sent a spacecraft there, although we couldn't measure just how hot it was. It turns out that Jupiter emits, gives off into space, 2.5 times as much heat as it receives from the sun. And that was really quite a surprise when Pioneer 10 got around onto the night side of Jupiter for the first time. If you think about it for a moment, since the Earth is much closer to the Sun than Jupiter is, all we can ever see is the side that is lighted up by the Sun. In other words, the day side. So we can't really measure the temperature of the radiation that Jupiter itself is emitting. And when Pioneer 10 became the first spacecraft to be able to do that for us, it turned out that it was that hot. Well, the reason for it is very simple. Jupiter is this enormous amount of material, 318 times as heavy as the Earth. And it all fell together, we think, in a relatively short period of time, probably no more than a few million years. 4.5 billion years ago. Well, the friction of this enormous amount of material, all suddenly, by geological or astronomical standards, falling together, heated it up, so heated the material so hot that for a brief period there, Jupiter must have had a temperature at the surface, even, of several hundred thousand degrees Fahrenheit. It doesn't have anything like that now. Now, its so-called surface is these very, very cold clouds. But inside, although it has cooled off a lot since those early days, it has not cooled off completely, and for 4.5 billion years, it has not cooled off completely, and it is still retaining a certain amount of that of residual heat left over from its original formation 4.6 billion years ago. Jupiter is cooling off every day. It's a little bit colder today than it was yesterday. As it cools off, it shrinks. It contracts, right? Things contract as they cool. Pulse. Okay, we had several other questions, and I think the next one was down in here somewhere. No way, and that's the big difference between Jupiter and a star. And that's why I say it is not correct to say that Jupiter is really a star, although it is certainly correct to say it's a very different kind of body from the Earth. A star is a body that is very, very much heavier than Jupiter, so that when it formed, the amount of friction generated, and therefore the internal temperature, was not just a few hundred thousand degrees, but millions of degrees. And that is hot enough that, number one, a star is not liquid throughout the way Jupiter is. It is gaseous throughout. And that means that it's very, very much bigger than it would be if it were cold, because a gas is a substance in which there is a lot of space between the atoms and molecules compared to the space that is taken up with the atoms and molecules, whereas a liquid or a solid is a substance where the atoms and molecules that it's made of are touching one another. And so our Sun, which is a typical star and is 1,000 times as heavy as Jupiter, see, I told you Jupiter is 2.5 times as heavy as everything else in the solar system put together. What I didn't mention was I was leaving out the Sun. If you consider the Sun, then over 99.5% of the 2 billion, billion, billion tons of the solar system is made of, that's 2 octillion tons if you rather think of it that way, is the Sun. But of what's left over afterwards, about over two-thirds is Jupiter. Well, the Sun is so big, I told you if Jupiter were hollow, you could drop in 1,000 Earths. If the Sun was just an average-sized star or hollow, you could drop in 1,000 Jupiters. And the reason the Sun is so huge is that it is a gas and therefore is expanded very, very much bigger than it would be if it were cold. In fact, the Sun is so big that if it were hollow, you could drop in 1,000,000 Earths. When the Sun is finally dead and has cooled off, it will be only about 30 times the volume of the Earth. In other words, no, I'm doing that wrong, about 3 times the diameter of the Earth, which would be 3 cubed is 27. Okay, roughly 30 times the volume of the Earth. So you see the difference there. I'm going to have more to say about that whole question about why things are the size they are 2 weeks from now when I talk about the Saturn lecture. It's a very interesting situation with Saturn and Jupiter, which you've known about long before Pioneer 11 got to Saturn. And that is that Saturn is almost the size of Jupiter. Jupiter's equatorial diameter is 86,500 miles, Saturn's is 74,000, so Saturn would be like this. You know, smaller than Jupiter, but only a little bit. And yet, Saturn is less than a third as heavy as Jupiter. So the obvious question comes about, you know, if Jupiter is so much heavier, over 3 times heavier, why isn't 3 times bigger? That's a very interesting question. It's a very non-obvious question. But that's for 2 weeks from now. Okay, a star is so hot that it is capable of generating its own energy and thereby keeping itself hot by a process called thermonuclear reaction. That I haven't got time to go into. It's too peripheral to this lecture. Many of you know what it means anyway. It's what happens in a hydrogen bomb. It's what gives the enormous amount of energy to get out of a hydrogen bomb. And the point is that in order to ignite, in order to start up thermonuclear reactions, you need to have a certain critical temperature inside the star, about 5 million degrees Fahrenheit. There is no way that the falling together of the amount of material made of Jupiter, heavy though it is compared to the Earth, there is no way that it's enough to have generated anything like that kind of temperature. And so these popularizers of astronomy who have made this kind of statement, you know, Jupiter is really a star instead of a planet, you confront them with all this, you say, no, it doesn't have thermonuclear reactions, it's not a gas, it's a liquid, and some of them say, well, yeah, see, what I really meant was if Jupiter were heavier, it would have been a star. Well, yes. This is true. If you were heavier, you would have been a star. You know, I mean, where do you stop? If Jupiter were 60 times as heavy as it is, then it would have been a star. Well, I looked up the numbers. If I were 60 times as heavy as I am, I'd have been an elephant. I don't think that makes me almost as heavy as an oak, you see. And so what these people are really trying to say, very poorly, is that Jupiter is a very different kind of body from the Earth, and it is like a star in one respect, that is made mostly of hydrogen and helium, but that's the only respect, and there are a lot of differences between Jupiter and a star. Okay, this that I told you so far, plus the obvious facts that you can see from the pictures, such as the clouds that are arranged in stripes, and they're alternating dark and bright stripes, and there are these spots like the great red spot and the smaller ones here, are what we knew basically about Jupiter from Earth. I might mention, by the way, parenthetically, there are technical terms for bright stripes and dark stripes which I am not going to use because they're so non-obvious that it's very hard for people to remember which is which, I think. The term for a bright stripe is a zone, the term for a dark stripe is a belt, and the term for either kind of stripe is a band. And, you know, there's just nothing obvious to me about the word zone that implies that it's bright. But I'm mentioning this because if you ever go out and do any reading about Jupiter, you run into these innocent-looking words like zone and belt, and unless somebody has told you those are technical terms, you know, they have very definite meaning, your eye would just skim right over them and you'll never even realize what it is that whoever you're reading is trying to tell you. Okay, this is one of the very finest pictures of Jupiter ever taken from the Earth. Here comes a picture of Jupiter that was taken by the absolutely incredible cameras of Voyager 1. Voyager 1, like Voyager 2, the spacecraft are essentially identical, has two cameras, and they are phenomenal cameras. They are very, very much better than the ones on the Pioneer. I'm sure some of you who have seen the Pioneer Saturn pictures were kind of disappointed in them because you might have seen some of the Voyager pictures of Jupiter and they are so spectacular. I'll have more to say about that when I give you the Saturn lecture in 2 weeks, part of which is the Pioneer pictures are not as bad as the first versions look. They happen to require extensive computer processing. Voyager pictures don't. And also, Pioneers can do some things better than Voyagers, but picture taking doesn't happen to be among them. But the Voyager, well, the so-called wide-angle camera, you know, the one that shows the wider field of view but less detail, as opposed to the narrow angle, which has finer detail, but of course over a more restricted field of view. The so-called wide-angle camera has a field of view 1.5 degrees wide, which, if you're into 35mm photography, is a rather extreme telephoto by anybody else's standards. The narrow-angle camera has 1/7 that field of view, and that camera is so sharp in the detail that it can show that it could easily separate the two eyes of a housefly photographed at the other end of a football stadium. So it's a fantastically good camera. The flyby, the closest approach of Voyager 1 to Jupiter was in March. In December, that spacecraft was taking better pictures than we can ever get from Earth. So we have month after month after month of Voyager observation, of a continuous Voyager observation of Jupiter, and you can watch the storm systems go on, and I will show you time-lapse films of that shortly, and you'll see it's very spectacular. Let's start out, though, with just a single shot. This is a picture that was taken in February, over a month before Closest Encounter, from 20 million miles out by Voyager 1, and there's the kind of detail you can see. Well, immediately you see that you get the same kind of impression. Oh, I should explain, the colors and the contrast on these Voyager pictures that I'm going to show you are somewhat exaggerated, not enormously, not extremely, not anything like the contrast exaggeration in those ultraviolet images of Venus, for example, but they're a little bit exaggerated. But this is very nearly what you would see if you had a... if your eyes were good enough, if your eyes were as good as those cameras, and if you were riding on the spacecraft out there. This is the great red spot, which you see shows all kinds of detail, and you begin to get the idea as to what it is, that it's a hurricane. You can see fantastic amounts of detail, but you can also begin to see they fall into a relatively small number of classical features. That is, everything seems to be oriented along the east-west direction. So it looks as though, I think you have an intuitive impression, which is correct, that the planet's rotation is somehow causing most of the appearance that you're seeing there. And in fact, you notice that the appearance of the various stripes seems to depend on latitude. That is to say, on distance from the equator, and is along the equator where the rotation is strongest. So along the equator, you have nothing but smooth, bright clouds, a zone, the light color kinds of clouds, except that at the north edge of that equatorial zone, You have regions where material comes up from below the clouds. That's not obvious, that's what's happening in this one picture, but in the moon it's very obvious. Comes out, spills out, and immediately gets shoved downwind by the downstream for thousands and thousands of miles. Remember, please, the Earth would be about the size of this, right here. So enormous distances by the winds, which are obviously being caused by the rotation. Then you have a region of turbulence at both edges of that equatorial zone. It looks as though there are very different wind systems there, and they are pushing past one another and distorting the fluid, distorting the gas as they go by. Then you have a region which in the northern hemisphere, in these pictures, is broad and relatively featureless. In the southern hemisphere, it's much narrower. There's a light-colored region, rather. Then you have a region where you begin to get, for the first time, these individual, I'll go ahead and tell you what they are, they're storm systems. And in fact, everything that you're seeing here, this is the Voyager 1 Discovery, everything that you're seeing that is oval, that is roughly circular, you can see how it's been squeezed out by, again, the east-west wind through the planet's rotation. Everything that you're seeing there is a storm system, except that, unlike hurricanes on Earth, you know, what I'm telling you is the Great Red Spot is a hurricane. 2.5 times the diameter of the Earth, which has been going on in Jupiter's atmosphere for at least 300 years and shows no sign of letting up. How can I tell you 300 years? Well, the telescopes are 300 years. For all we know, it's millions of years old. But that's what it is. And these smaller things are hurricanes also, except that the direction that the winds go around them is anticyclonic, which means the direction that you expect from a high-pressure system on the Earth. And hurricanes on the Earth are low-pressure systems, and they have winds going in the opposite direction, so-called cyclonic. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean the Great Red Spot is different from terrestrial hurricanes in the sense that it's a high-pressure center instead of a low-pressure center, because it turns out that although in a hurricane on the Earth, most of the winds, certainly the winds that hit the ground, are in the cyclonic direction. At the very top of the storm, the wind flow actually reverses, and you have a region of anticyclonic circulation. And of course, at the top of the storm, that you see in the picture from space. So that works out. Now, these storm systems begin to appear at about this latitude in both hemispheres. There is nothing in the northern hemisphere like the Great Red Spot, but other than that, the same thing is true at that latitude in both hemispheres. You see these. You begin to see the ovals. Then you have a region which is not terribly well shown here, where you have individual brown barge-shaped elongated features. And then from there to the pole, you have a region where there isn't very much striking, and where, in fact, all you have is little individual storm systems, which to be sure are elongated, but they don't form a continuous strike. I don't think it takes too much imagination to realize that whole kind of variation from the equator up to the pole is caused by the fact that at the equator, the rotational speed is fastest, as you move up to the pole, it becomes less and less. Is it obvious why? You know, I mean, the thing goes around once every 10 hours, and that's true whether you're standing on the equator or whether you're standing up at the pole. If you're standing 1 foot from the pole, you have to do a 1 foot circle in 10 hours. If you're standing at the equator, you have to go all the way around the equatorial circumference of Jupiter in the same length of time. So naturally, your linear speed, your east-west speed, is faster to the equator. And in fact, Jupiter rotates so fast that it has by far the, Saturn is almost as short. It has the shortest day of any planet in the solar system. This whole enormous object, 1,000 times as heavy as the Earth, is swinging around its axis once every 10 hours, which means that a point on the equator of Jupiter is moving simply by virtue of its rotation almost as fast as an Apollo spacecraft leaving Earth to go to the moon, 22,000 miles an hour. By comparison, the Apollo spacecraft is 25,000 miles an hour, and a point on the equator of the Earth is about 1,000 miles an hour. So you can see rotation is going to be very important.
Is the equatorial diameter then greater?
The equatorial diameter is greater than the polar diameter by almost the diameter of the Earth. And I have a picture coming up. So far, you haven't been able to see that very well because it's always been a part of the dark side of Jupiter in each of the pictures I've shown you. I have one coming up that is a full Jupiter taken from the Earth, which I selected to illustrate exactly that point. And the polar flattening, or the equatorial bulge, whichever you want to think of, is very dramatic. If you look at a picture, well, let me say that when I get to the picture I'm talking about. This is a Pioneer 10 image of Jupiter that was taken 5 years earlier. And, of course, you can see it's not as detailed, but part of the reason, a good part, and that's the shadow wheel, by the way, a good part of the reason for the difference is real changes in Jupiter over those 5 years. And the problem with a picture like this one is, yes, it's a wonderful picture, but everybody gets the idea that's the way Jupiter always looks. And you've got to realize there is change in Jupiter that has to be explained, and some of the changes are long-term and some of them are short-term. For example, take these spots. The Great Red Spot, which is the biggest of them all, biggest we've ever seen, has lasted for at least 300 years. Other than that, they never last longer than a few months or weeks, or in very rare cases, a couple of Earth years, with the exception of three spots roughly equally spaced at this latitude in the southern hemisphere only, which are known as the long-lived ovals because they have been around since the 1930s. And so you've got to explain two things about Jupiter. One, its changeability. Two, however, equally important, things that do not change. There is a remarkable amount of stability on this planet. The stripes that you see at these various latitudes, dark and bright, are always at those latitudes. They change their appearance, they change their thickness, they change their color, but they never change their identity. To the point that, although I'm not going to use the names, every one of these bright and dark stripes has a name of its own. They're so permanent, it's possible to give them names. Those names were given, over half a century ago now, and they're still in use. And I think I already did give you one of the names, the equatorial zone. And, you know, north tropical zone, north temperate band, so forth and so on. There has never been, in the history of telescopic observation of Jupiter, a change in the existence of one of the brighter dark stripes. That is to say, we've never seen one that used to exist go away, or we've never seen one that didn't exist come into existence, with the exception that there used to be a bright stripe down here. It even had a name of its own, the South Temperate Zone. At the end of the 1930s, that stripe developed 3 pinches in it, about 120 degrees apart. In other words, about a third of the way around the planet, separated. So for a little while there, it looked like 3 sausages, you might think of. And then those pinches split off, and the result, the sausages contracted. So there was dark material in between now, from above, from the north and the south. And they contracted very, very rapidly at first, and then more and more and more and more slowly, and became the 3 one-lined ovals. The ovals were given names FA, BC, and DE. This particular one is BC. So if any of you know Johnny Hart, tell him they're BC. And they have been contracting ever since. They've been around ever since. They've apparently had this cyclonic circulation ever since. They're right there in the valley, southern hemisphere. They don't go away. The others all go away after a relatively short period of time. And yet, the stripes do not go away. So we have to explain two things if we want to understand the atmosphere of Jupiter, and we cannot explain them yet. I mean, this I'm throwing out as a state of the art at this point. We've discovered that there are two things we have to explain. One, the changeability, but two, the many things on Jupiter which do not change. Okay, well, here is an example of variability within the framework that they don't change. If you remember, now let me go back to Voyager 6 and point out specifically. Take the 2 bright stripes at these latitudes on either side of the equator. Okay, this one here and this one here. The one in the northern hemisphere is broad and relatively featureless. The one in the southern hemisphere is not as bright. It is narrow and it has a lot of structure and it has a lot of detail in it. 5 years ago, it was just the other way around. The one, come on, forward. Sorry, it's my fault, not the machine. The one in the northern hemisphere was narrow, and it doesn't look as though it has a lot of detail, but remember, this is not as sharp a picture. And probably, in fact, it looked rather like the one in the southern hemisphere now. The one in the southern hemisphere, the one that contains the Great Red Spot, was very broad, very bright, and pretty much featureless. Let's show you another difference. Look at the Great Red Spot 5 years ago. I'm sorry, actually this was 6 years ago, but the Pioneer 11 pictures a year later look pretty much like this too. The Great Red Spot then was much redder than it is now, featureless. You don't see all the detail. You don't see the turbulent, complex turbulent zone downstream of it, and you don't see structure around it. Coming forward 5 years later, you see the Great Red Spot is much less red, and that's a real color difference. That it has a lot of structure in it, that it has this complex turbulence downstream, and that it has this eye-like appearance due to structure around it. Well, we watch Jupiter from the Earth, of course. It's not as though all we ever do is send spacecraft to it. And so, although we cannot see it as well as a Voyager or even a Pioneer, we can see it well enough that I can tell you the history of this particular change. Jupiter looked like this in 1973 when Pioneer 10 took this picture. It looked like this in 1974 when Pioneer 11 went down. And it looked like this for about an Earth year after. And then, rather suddenly, in a period of just a few months, its appearance reverted from this to this. And it's been that way ever since. And now it is showing signs of changing back. The Voyager 2 pictures show an appearance that looks a little bit more like that Pioneer appearance than the versions you're seeing here in Voyager 1. And in fact, they were hoping when they saw the changes beginning to occur from Earth between the two Voyager flybys, which after all were only 4 months apart, they were hoping they might have the fantastic luck of actually being able to photograph a change in this kind of detail as Voyager 2 flew in. Well, unfortunately, nature was kind, but it wasn't that kind. And the change seemed to sort of start and then freeze, and Voyager 2 flew fast. And, you know, maybe it will pick up again. But we were not lucky enough to be able to get it with spacecraft. Well, okay, here's one appearance of Jupiter. Here is another appearance of Jupiter. There are others. And over the last 100 years or so, it's been systematically monitored, the appearance of the planet, and we know that it has a number of different phases that it can put on, and that it can change from one to another. And yet, you have underlying all that, this constancy, this stability, that the strikes are always in about the same place, depending on the variations in how wide each one is. The central latitude of each one is always about the same. A better way to put it would be the BC moves relative to the red spot. Determining the rotation period of a planet with no solid surface and with all these clouds and with storm systems is tough. If you looked at the Earth, you know, and if we were totally covered by clouds, so you could see all of our winds the way Jupiter is, you would have the same kind of problem. In our particular latitudes, the wind blows from the west to the east, as you probably know from following television weather maps. There are other latitudes where they blow from east to the west. And so if you're determining the period of rotation by looking at how long it takes a given feature to go around the planet, well, you would measure a different number for our latitudes than you would in some latitude where the wind is east-west. Of course, the extreme example of that is Venus, where the cloud features move around every 4 days and the planet turns out to move around every 243. That one you understand at all. In the case of Jupiter, well, you have very strong winds both in east-west and west-east direction, which you will see dramatically when I show you that time-lapse film. And so it's a little bit tough to decide what the rotation period of the planet is. But radio astronomy comes to our aid. Jupiter emits radio waves, which apparently are determined by, in other words, get stronger and fainter because of the rotation of Jupiter's magnetic field. The magnetic field, we think, is generated in that metallic hydrogen layer inside the planet. And so the period with which the radio waves increase in intensity and decrease in intensity and then increase again gives you the rotation period of the interior of the planet. And that rotation period is the one that I cited as being about a little under 10 hours. It's 9 hours, 56 minutes, and some odd seconds, as I remember. And that is the so-called System 3 rotation period. Well, the movies I'm going to show you, the time-lapse movie I'm going to show you where Jupiter's rotation has been stopped, is set to the System 3 rotation period. On that rotation period, the red spot moves hardly at all. But if you watch over a period of a month or so, BC moves past the red spot, and BC moves about that far in a month. So you're constantly, these long black ovals are constantly moving past the red spot in that direction. Sometimes you see one under it, sometimes you see another under it, and sometimes you don't see any under it. Unfortunately, the interval between Voyagers 1 and 2 was just long enough to allow one long-lived oval to be replaced by another which appeared in almost exactly the same position relative to the red spot. We were hoping to be able to get close-up pictures that showed what that region south of the red spot looked like when it's not distorted by the presence of a long-lived oval, but nature wasn't that kind either. So, does that answer your question? Okay, fine. The reason I asked that was I wasn't quite sure that I remembered the exact words of the question because I said so much myself. Which is an occupational hazardous trait. Okay, here is an image from Pioneer 10, which is much less exciting than anything I've shown you so far as a visual object, but equally important. This is a map of the temperature. I showed you a very similar one from a very similar instrument on Pioneer Venus Orbiter. This is the infrared radiometer, which measures temperatures, and it worked at Jupiter at the same time as the imaging system was looking at it, and took pictures, took data, which have been used to make pictures like this, in which it's coded so the hotter, the brighter. Okay, so this is a bright region, and this is a dim region. And we've already gone through this in Venus, so I can say it real fast. Part of the reason I spent more time on Venus than any other planet is that whatever one happened to be the first one, that was going to be the one where I introduced basic concepts, and so now they apply to all the others. If Jupiter had been first, they probably would have given it to them. And the same thing on Venus as on Venus, that is the cloud regions which were dark to the eye in the visual light are the ones that are the hottest. And so those are places where there are holes, where we are seeing further down into the atmosphere, and we are seeing down to a lower layer of clouds. In other words, the bright clouds are not everywhere over the planet. The dark clouds may be everywhere over the planet. In any case, there are many places where we can see them through the bright clouds. There are also, however, in more detailed mapping, which has actually been done since from the Earth, other hot spots on Jupiter, and particularly these ovals, these rings, brown rings that you get at this latitude in the northern hemisphere, there's nothing exactly like in the same latitude in the southern hemisphere. Those are hot spots, and those are apparently places where we are seeing down to some sort of upwelling in the center, which brings up bright cloud material, but in the dark ring around it, in the downwelling region around it, where the air is being pushed aside, and so the clouds are being pushed aside, and we can see down to a lower layer in the atmosphere where there happens to be a level of brown cloud. So that's the thermal situation for Jupiter. Now here was that picture that I promised you, which I think dramatically illustrates the rotation of Jupiter. And you can see it is very, very much fatter through the equator than it is through the poles. If you look at a picture of the full Earth taken from space, as far as your eye can see, the outline is an absolutely perfect circle. The Earth does bulge at the equator as a result of its rotation, but the equatorial diameter is only 1/3 of 1% greater than the polar diameter. In the case of Jupiter, it's almost 10% greater. So you can really see the bulge, and that's a very obvious thing when you look at Jupiter through a telescope. At this point, I'm going to show you the first of the films, and this particular one was made by taking Voyager 1 images every 12 minutes, I think it was. It's a little bit complicated because a Voyager 1 color picture is not a single snapshot. You take a picture through a blue filter, which allows only the blue end of the spectrum to go through. You take a picture through a yellow filter or a green filter, which allows only the middle part of the spectrum to go through. You take a picture through a red filter, which allows the high wavelength end of the spectrum to go through. And then you combine those three pictures, and the way human color vision works, if you do that, you get full color. But the pictures have to be taken at a minimum 48 seconds apart. And so what they did was take a cluster of these three pictures every 48 seconds apart, and then I think the number is 12 minutes later, another cluster. And they did that for 2.5 Jupiter rotations. In other words, for about one Earth day. And then put them together into a time-lapse movie, which actually shows Jupiter rotating before your eyes, speeded up by a factor of 3,600. You have probably never seen a planet actually rotate before, and so I wanted to show you this film. It speeded up by such an amount that what happened on the real planet in 1 hour is shown in the film in 1 second. See, that's a factor of 3,600. And what will happen is Jupiter will go around and around and around. You'll see the red spot go by and side opposite the red spot, which people like me never show you in these lectures because the red spot is always so spectacular. And then toward the end, you'll see two of Jupiter's planet-sized moons come into view. First, as I remember, first Europa, which is the second from the inside, it's white, and it goes across the field of view, and then Io, the little red one, the innermost one, it's bigger than our own moon, comes through, and then you see the shadow of Europa go across the clouds, and then the shadow of Io, and all of this speeded up. So here is the rotation film, Voyager 1 rotation film. 2.5 days on Jupiter. That can probably be a little better focus. It's almost that, but that's it. Okay, start out with a freeze frame just to establish the action. One wide oval. Second one. third one. There comes Europa. I do know the right. There's Io. Look how red it is. Shadow of Europa. Shadow of Io. Film off, slides on for you. Yeah. Blue halo around Jupiter. Yeah, there is, isn't there? I don't know if that's real or not. That, no, this picture is taken through a reflector, so it's not chromatic aberration, which is a defect that can, it's a defect in the sense that we don't like it. It's sort of a normal property of the lens, which can do exactly that. I don't know, maybe it's really scattering. You remember the physics that I, the geometry that I showed you last time, where if you're looking at the edge of a planet, you're looking so that your line of sight is going through a deep atmospheric path compared to if you're looking down the center? Well, as a result of that, since you're looking through more clear air here, see, before, with Venus was a different situation. There you had a foggy cloud, diffuse cloud that you could see a fair distance into, and it was a question of how far into your line of sight was penetrating. Here you have a rather well-defined cloud, but above it there's a considerable amount of clear air.